Ben Charles Padilla was a 50-year-old from Pensacola, Florida. He was a licensed aircraft mechanic, flight engineer, and a pilot of small airplanes. He was on a job in Luanda, Angola, overseeing the refurbishing of a 727. On the evening of May 25, 2003, with the job almost completely done, an assistant and he went out to the plane to test its engines. Minutes later, the 727 rolled down the runway and took off. Neither the plane nor the men have ever been seen again. I'm Ed Denzel, and this is Unfound. Ever since I was a little kid, I've been fascinated by mysteries and disappearances. I, as a kid, watched In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. It also helped that at that time I was slowly becoming a Star Trek fan. I continue to be a Star Trek fan to this day. But I can remember on Saturdays, I think the show used to be on Saturday afternoons for some reason that In Search Of was on. And I think now, by this time, being 46 years old, I think I've seen every episode. And then later, I think maybe when I got into my teenage years, my early 20s, I began to become fascinated, and what I guess you would say morbidly fascinated, with plane crashes. Maybe it helps that I don't like to fly that much. But I've become a walking encyclopedia for plane crashes. You tell me about a plane crash, I can probably tell you what caused it, the airline, maybe even the year, the location, just because I've watched every Mayday episode that's out there. I've read every Wikipedia article. I've also watched Aircraft Investigation. I guess there's that show, 60 Seconds to Disaster, whatever that show is, that sometimes covers plane crashes. I've seen them all. And so I couldn't pass up the opportunity to do a show regarding the disappearance of a person and then possibly the crashing of an airplane. Seemed like the perfect combination, despite it being sad circumstances in which a family has lost a family member. In this case, Ben Charles Padilla. And we'll get into that in the interview that I'm going to give you with this show. However, there's another part of this that I thought was interesting, and it's not just about me for the show, but for you, that you're going to be amazed to hear about the second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand jet market that exists in the world these days. It is shadier than reverse mortgages. It is shadier than your average used car salesman. It is shadier than penny stocks or some of the shenanigans that go on Wall Street. And in this interview that you're going to hear, you're going to start wondering how more of these planes don't end up in the wrong hands. And not just the wrong hands as we get into the interview, with drug runners or something like that, some group like that, but for terrorists. And in fact, with the year that Ben Charles Padilla and this jet that disappeared, it was 2003. It wasn't that long after the United States went into Iraq, not even 2 years after September 11th, and we know how the terrorists went about conducting their attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon, and then the jet that went down in Shanksville. So you can imagine that there was a lot of concern regarding the disappearance of this jet. Now, the reason the jet was there, it was originally a jet from American Airlines, a 727. If you don't know what a 727 is, it is a jet with three engines, two at the back of the fuselage and then one up on the tail. There's another jet called an L-1011 or the DC-10 that are similar in design, but they're bigger than this type of jet. It's more along the lines of the size of a 737. But it was there in Angola because it was going to be used to carry oil to the diamond mines throughout Africa. What was going on in Angola and elsewhere? There were civil wars going on, and the roads simply weren't passable. To try to get oil and machinery to these mines was just asking for the trucks and the equipment to get stolen or blown up, shot up, people, the drivers dead. So it was more efficient and safer and probably more cost-effective at that point to fly the oil in. Now, you can imagine putting oil tanks in a jet is not a common enterprise. And once again, we get into the interview. I'm going to tell you who the interview is with in a matter of moments. But that's why the jet was there in the first place. Its call sign, the tail number of the plane was N844AA. It was 727 that was in pretty good condition when it got to Africa. And then it was used for some missions. And then what happened was the Civil War ended, and then flying oil into these places did not, you didn't need a jet anymore. You could simply then once again go back to trucking the oil in, and at that point it became more cost effective. Now, in this upcoming interview, the interview is actually with Tim Wright. I tracked him down, and he was so gracious to a couple talks. We had one conversation that went on for a while, and then a couple weeks later is when I did the interview with him that you will hear in its entirety with no edits. He wrote an article in 2010. It came out in 2010, but he worked on this story for a while, and it was a story for Air and Space magazine. And if you look Tim up, you're going to find him to be a very legitimate writer. He did a lot of travel and research for this article, and he does for everything that he writes. He is a well-known guy within the aviation industry, has a lot of good contacts within the industry. And in his story, he was able to talk to many of the players in this story, and we threw around some names in this story when you get to hear this interview, and you need to know who some of these people are because we don't go into actually who they are. The names are kind of just mentioned and we keep moving. You're going to hear the name Keith Irwin in this article. He was the South African businessman who was trying to put the deal together for his aircraft company to haul to the diamond mines. All right, so he was the one that went about finding this 727, this former American Airlines 727 in the first place, part of a South African conglomerate that wanted to do business. They saw a business opportunity to make money. And Keith Irwin was the guy who brought the plane to Africa in the first place. You're going to hear the name Maury Joseph. He was the person who owned the 727 after it was with American Airlines. He owned, I don't know if he still does, but he owned a leasing company. So Keith Irwin was acquiring the jet, but he wasn't buying the jet. He was going to lease the jet from Maury Joseph. It would still be Maury Joseph's jet, even though it was over in Africa doing this job, being used for this purpose. You're also going to hear the name Mike Gabriel. Well, he works for Maury Joseph, and he was the guy who was sent to Africa when the jet went to Africa, and he was the one to make sure that Maury Joseph ended up getting his money from Keith Irwin. So Mike Gabriel was over there keeping an eye on Ben Charles Padilla. He was the guy to make sure that the money eventually got back to Maury Joseph. And there's one more name that was mentioned, Kip Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y. Tim mentions his name in talking to this guy regarding this disappearance. And Kip Hawley used to be the head of the TSA in the United States. So like I said, and Tim has a lot of great connections. And doing this article, the article I will link to for this show, you'll get to read the original article. I consider it to be the definitive article on the disappearance of Ben Charles Padilla and this jet. But he got to interview all of these people, and it is a fascinating story. It is also a story that makes you wonder a lot about what is going on in the jet market, even all these years later. The jet market, the second-hand, fourth-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand jet market is just as shady today as it was in 2003. And in fact, you'll hear in the interview that Tim Wright continues to work on this story to this day. He has a lot of suspicions that he voices in the interview. And I try to ask him the questions that I think all of you would ask him if you got a chance to talk to him. And also I ask him some clarifications about the jet, so any of you out there who aren't familiar with jets can kind of get an idea of the jet, what it does, how people use it, the work that was being done on it, because I think it helps you understand the story. So here you go, my interview with Tim Wright, the writer of the definitive article on the disappearance of Ben Charles Padilla and the 727. He wrote it for Air and Space magazine in 2010. I'm calling this episode Ben Charles Padilla and the Darker Side of Aviation. And here's my interview with Tim Wright. Now on the show, I have Mr. Tim Wright, the person I consider to have written the definitive article on the disappearance of Ben Charles Padilla. Thanks for joining me today, Tim.
Oh, my pleasure, sir.
Like I said, I consider you to be the definitive source on this story. You wrote this story in 2010. Tell the listeners how you got involved, and then we'll just go from there.
Well, I've been a journalist with working with Smithsonian Air and Space since the mid-90s, and I've been very fortunate in that the vast majority of my assignments have been ideas that I suggested. So when this airplane first disappeared, I was just agog by it. I just thought it was the most interesting thing. So I pitched it to my editors, and you have to understand that Air and Space is a bi-monthly publication, so it can't really do anything that's breaking news. So they took a pass on it at that time. Then years later, they came back to me saying that they wanted to do a special issue on mysteries, aviation mysteries.
Interesting.
Okay. And so I said, well, you know, we still have this 727 that's missing. And my editor said, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Well, why don't you give me, you know, 500 or 600 words? And I did that. And then she says, well, why don't you go 800 to 1,000? I did that. And then she said, well, let's go ahead and go for maybe 2,000. And I did that. But by the time this story was turned in, I had hit like 12,000 words. And it was a never-ending expansion into amazing, bizarre, and totally complete surprises. So nobody was really prepared for where it went.
So, but initially, the Air and Space magazine said, I were a little leery on that, but then a few years later, what year would you say that you then really started jumping deep into this with both feet?
2009. It took me about a year of digging and phone calling and searching. And once I turned in the text, they turned it around and put it in print pretty quickly. So, just about a year or so. A lot of the stories I do have very, very long lead times, unfortunately.
So what you're telling me is, you know, I get the feeling when you're talking about that this is almost like when Watergate came along for Woodward and Bernstein. This is like a career-defining story. Would you call it that?
That's not a bad analogy, I guess. I certainly didn't realize I had a tiger by the tail when I grabbed it.
Mm-hmm.
And once the story came out in print, people started contacting me out of the woodwork. You know, people that come from the darker side of aviation or who are very familiar with it. And that's where my real education began, because we went from looking at just one single airplane to a systemic industry-wide problem.
Mm, right, and I hope to get into that in a little bit. So you, like you said, it was like a little bit of a maze trying to get to the bottom of all this. Tell us a little bit about that. Some of the people, and maybe that day where you figured out, man, this is a little bit more than I thought it was going to be.
Well, there wasn't a specific day that I went, holy crud. You know,
okay.
It was just a slow, fascinating evolution, and it became a compulsion to me. And some people will say that it still is, because I'm still working on this story.
Yeah, because it's unsolved.
It's unsolved, and new information comes in even now, although not with the speed that it once did. So we still kick things around. But one of the most helpful contacts I made was with Mike Gabriel,
mm-hmm.
who had been hired by Maury Joseph, who owned the airplanes,
mm-hmm.
operated the airplane. Mike was invaluable to me. He was always available for a phone call. He always shared whatever he knew with me. He was just a huge, huge assistance in the initial chasing of the story.
Yeah.
And Maury Joseph, I had the opportunity to speak with him on numerous occasions, and he provided some great information. And one or two of the original crew members were very helpful as well. But most of the American crew did not want to talk about this in any way, shape, or form. They just wanted to close their eyes and let the whole thing go away.
These were the crew members that were originally hired to fly the plane in Africa for its intended use, to haul oil to these diamond mines.
That's correct.
Okay. And why do you think they were afraid? What do you think?
Because they broke a lot of rules.
Oh.
The FAA has some very distinct rules you have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And their modification of the aircraft with the fuel tanks took place outside of the United States to get around some of those rules and regulations. They did some. One of the crew members, you know, admitted to scavenging off a recently crashed 727. In fact, an aircraft that had crashed just before they did. They helped the crew of this other 727 get out of there, but before they helped them, they helped themselves to some of the parts that they needed for their airplane.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's just a small sampling of some of the craziness that went on.
So the plane was never used for its intended use. It sat there for a while. Okay.
It did. It's a complicated story.
Yeah.
The airplane, or Keith Irwin, the South African who arranged the cruise and brought it over,
mm-hmm.
Ran out of cash, and the deal that he had made with some Angolan folks went south very quickly. And his partners down in South Africa were not happy, and the crew was scared, literally. Some of them thought they weren't going to get out of there alive.
Mm-hmm.
And And then that those crews, I think they might have flown one or two flights or two or three flights. Anyway, the aircraft eventually made about 17 sorties.
Oh, that many? I didn't know that. Okay, 17.
Yeah, 17. And then it sat on the ramp for about 14 months or so before Ben Charles Padilla showed up and got the aircraft airworthy again, and then that's when it disappeared. What killed the main deal for this airplane was the peace that came to Angola. And, you know, the airplane was delivering diesel fuel to all these rebel-held diamond mines mm-hmm. from the communist capital of Luanda. And the fact that it was crossing the front lines every day, to me, is still just amazing.
It is.
But the roads were just not an option. They just weren't an option. But once the peace came, those roads opened up immediately. And the market for these fuel deliveries being made by aircraft imploded because it was far cheaper to do it by truck.
Right.
So when the peace set, the airplane lost its market, and it just basically sat there on the ramp in Luanda until Padilla showed up.
Let's talk about Mr. Padilla, being that he is the reason I became interested in this, being that he's still a disappeared person. He's a little bit of he was a guy who kind of went around the world, it seems, to places like this to fix planes.
Yeah, that's true. Mari Joseph had hired him to go to Nigeria. Jeff Swain, who was also in the large aircraft business, had hired him to do some work for him in Indonesia. And I talked to some friends of his that had flown with him down into South America and some other places. And I talked to some folks who knew him from his days working in Nigeria. So. Yeah, Mari said that he was the kind of guy you could send to just about any part of the world to do a job, and he would do it.
In reading your article, and I'm going to link to that when we get the show posted and everything, people will be able to click on the link, read your original article. But you give kind of a almost a paradoxical view. Some people thought the world of Mr. Padilla. Others thought that he was a little bit of a big talker. You know, what did you decide regarding Mr. Padilla? In this.
Some of the stories I heard from people that knew him firsthand were horrifying.
Mm.
It was very difficult at times for me to be sympathetic to the gentleman.
Okay.
And I wanted to be.
Right, right. Know? Right, an American disappears in Africa, your natural inclination is to feel that way, sure.
Right, right, right. Well, the more I learned about him and his colorful ways and past, the harder it was to become sympathetic to him. Now, his family, his poor family, my heart goes out to him because they believed in they called him Charles.
Okay.
They believed in Ben and loved him and you know, always thought the best of him. But there were other people who knew him away from home. And if you talk to many folks who have been in Africa for an extended period of time, it's not uncommon to hear how that continent can change folks.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a sense of rules that exist here. I mean, in so many ways, it's the wild, wild west, and some people react to that freedom with abandonment in many ways.
Right, and he could have maybe gotten caught up in that being over there maybe so often over time.
Yeah, I think you know he was married, he had a daughter over here.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an adopted child, and I'd spent a lot of time talking to his daughter and his goddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even the two of them describe very different people.
Hmm.
Almost a night and day kind of relationship. And you know, it's just when he was here in the States, you know, I heard stories of, you know, bravado and daring do and this kind of stuff, and then I would hear from other people who would say, you know, it's complete smoke and mirrors on that. It was the people who traveled with him overseas that and worked with him overseas that really had the most disturbing things to say.
Mm. But he was, I mean, to put him in layman's terms, was he a mechanic? Is that the way that the average person would understand his job and doing what he was doing?
No. No, oh. He was not. He was a flight engineer.
Okay.
He was a systems management kind of guy. The 727 was a sports car of an airliner,
mm-hmm.
and it had a complex fuel system. And this was all before the age of computers and digitally managed fuel systems. So somebody had to sit there at the engineers panel and watch the fuel flows and manage them and control how what tank was, you know, being drawn from and all this kind of good stuff.
Okay.
While he certainly did a lot of more kind of what we call wrench turning,
mm-hmm.
Not an AMP to my understanding. He had done some sheet metal work before he got into aviation, but in order to be licensed to actually work on an aircraft, you have to have an FAA license, an airframe and power plant license. And to my knowledge, he did not have that. But he would, as flight engineer, he would be familiar with all the fuel systems, the hydraulic systems, the electrical systems. He would know the guts of the airplane in a very, very efficient, knowledgeable way.
Okay, and he must have been capable, being that he kept getting rehired to do jobs over and over, even though maybe his personal life was questionable. But doing that, being that he keeps getting rehired, I'm going to guess he was competent.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Okay.
I'm not really sure just how competent he was at it. But you're right. He did get rehired, and he did get hired for people. But he also got fired from people too. So even in the Miami area, Mike Gabriel knew him,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't have anything kind to say about him. And one of Mike's dear buddies thought the world of him. So you know, it's really. A quandary.
That's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde type of thing going on there. You know, one person thinks the world of them, another one doesn't want anything to do with them. That's interesting. Well, like I said at the beginning of the show, that I thought that to understand this disappearance, you have to understand the world of the buying and selling of planes on the secondary or even lesser than that market. Tell listeners a little bit about the airline market before we go too further. You know, what happens to a plane after it's with Southwest or American Airlines in this situation and then goes to a second carrier, then to a third carrier? In my feeling in reading your article, it sounds a little bit shady and very, I don't know, once again, to use that word, kind of a maze.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It is. It is. It does get shady, and it does get into a maze scenario. In fact, some of those mazes are very deliberate.
Okay.
Planes are deliberately made to disappear in piles of paperwork. Let's go back to 2001, 2002. The 727 was, up till the 737, the single most popular airplane Boeing ever made. I mean, they made gajillions of them.
Okay.
And after 9/11, passenger traffic plummeted, and the airlines were hurting. And they were looking at ways to save money, and they looked at their 727s, and they thought, you know what, this is a great airplane, but it's expensive to run. Its fuel economy is not the best.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started unloading the 727s by the dozen, and they were buying the 737s, the newer 757s and 767s, mainly because of their fuel efficiency. So these 727s, which may have cost them, you know, like $35 million brand new, were going for a song. And
in fact, this plane itself, in your article, it said went for $1 million. It was sold for $1 million.
Yeah.
That's like nothing. Yeah. I mean, that is unbelievable to me.
Well, I've seen prices that are even cheaper than that.
Wow.
You get to the point where the cost of maintaining the aircraft, keeping it legal, is more than the aircraft is worth. So airplanes, airliners have to go through periodic heavy-duty maintenance programs. And there's an A check, which isn't too bad. There's a B check that's a little more serious. And then there's a C check, which is a very expensive proposition. And then you go into a D check, which is essentially almost a total rebuild of the airplane. And it's easy for a C check to be more expensive than the airplane is even worth. So that's where things start getting really shady, because you're an unscrupulous operator. You might say, well, you know what? I'll buy that thing, and I'm going to fly the doors off of it as long as I can or until I get caught. And that's what happens. And most airplanes that are reaching that stage of life where it's sometimes more valuable to part the airplane than to sell it, even though it's fully airworthy, a lot of those airplanes go to Africa and Asia. And the ones in Africa tend to disappear or to be crashed or to just get damaged beyond repair. And airfields around Africa are littered with the hulls of airplanes that would have only minor damage here in the United States that would be well worth fixing if the aircraft was new. But over there, it's just not worth the time and money and effort it is to repair it. So they just walk away from it. And that's very common over there. And then what will happen is somebody will have an airplane that's fully flyable, but it needs that really expensive D-check, and they don't want to spend the money to do it. And then they'll stumble across another airframe that's parked on the side of a runway somewhere that is, you know, it's got weeds growing up through it. It'd never, ever fly again.
Mm-hmm.
But the data plate on it indicates that it's got maybe another 1,000 hours before it has to go into a D-check. So the enterprising and scrupulous guys will take the data plate off the worthless airplane and switch it with the data plate on the airplane that they're flying.
Oh my.
So suddenly the airplane that's flying just vanishes from the rolls. Nobody knows what happens to it. It just disappears. And it's reincarnated with the same serial number as the airplane that's sitting on the side of some, you know, dirt airstrip in the middle of nowhere. And that's what happens a lot of times. And when that happens, the aircraft is not getting the safety checks that it needs, and it can become a dangerous airplane just for the crews to fly in.
And bringing this back to this particular 727, what was its data plate, and what situation was it in at the point that Ben Charles Padilla and it disappeared?
Well, 44 Alpha was in wonderful shape before it left the United States. Flight crew members, one of the flight engineers, says it was the best airframe of the lot that they had to choose from. And it was in just great shape. So before they left Miami with it, they ripped out all the seats. They ripped out all the overhead insulation and the panels and everything. They gutted the interior of the aircraft. Then once they got it into Africa, I can't remember reason why, but they punched a hole in the pressure hull of the aircraft, which means the aircraft could no longer be pressurized,
mm.
which means you can't fly it at altitude where it's most efficient fuel-wise. So according to Jeff Swain, who looked at the aircraft, he said it was a piece of junk. It wasn't even worth buying, but it had great engines on it. And the engines alone made it a viable piece of property. And so that's what his interest was he didn't care about the airframe. All he wanted was the engines on it.
And so Ben Charles Padilla gets sent to Angola. He's working on this plane. That particular day, he goes out there. He has this assistant with him. They go out to the plane, and we'll get into that in a second. And the plane takes off, and it disappears. Are you telling me that it probably couldn't have reached altitude? You know, I don't know what would it be 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet before it needed to be pressurized, or what would the case be for something like that?
Well, you're supposed to be on oxygen above 14,000 feet. So the aircraft not being able to be pressurized meant it was going to be restricted to less than 14,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's range, and this is a point that we're investigating right now very acutely.
Okay.
Is just what kind of range that aircraft had at the lower altitudes. Some airplane engines, the fuel cost more than doubles if it has to fly at that altitude. But the information we're getting right now is that the penalty for the 727 was not as severe as it is in current aircraft. And that has serious impact on how far the airplane could have gone on that initial day that it disappeared.
Right. I guess we're doing a little foreshadowing regarding all of this. But how much fuel was in the plane? I know I asked you this when we first talked. How much fuel was in the plane when it took off that day?
But that's another point that we're still trying to ascertain.
Wow.
Now, aircraft carried... 8,090 gallons of internal fuel. It's made to carry that much fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But the tanks on the inside of the aircraft, which were meant to carry diesel fuel, there were 10 of them, and they each had 500 gallons. So you had another 5,000 gallons of potential fuel inside the aircraft. Now, more than one flight engineer has told me it would be really easy to plumb those tanks into the main fuel system. We have one report where the day before the airplane disappeared, that somebody walked into the fuel shack at Luanda and paid $93,000 in cash. Well, if you knew the price of Jet A fuel at that time, you would be able to figure out just how much fuel was loaded into the aircraft. Was it just the normal tanks, or was it the normal tanks plus the tanks inside the cabin?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things we're trying to figure out right now.
Just ballparking it, being that you're not just a writer, but you are a pilot. You have your license. You're experienced in flying. What would that come close, just off the top of your head, $93,000? I mean, what was the price of jet fuel at that time?
Well, we're still trying to nail that down.
Okay.
And I actually contacted a colleague of mine who's been instrumental in the search in Paris, and he turned around and contacted one of his guys who's in Iraq, of all places.
Hmm.
So this is very much a global story with people all over the world looking for it.
13 years later.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, if you add the two volumes together, you're looking at about 13,090 gallons of gas. If you divide that by $93,000, you come up with a fuel price of about $4.50 a gallon. That is not outside the realm of possibility. But, you know, mm-hmm. it's hard to tell how much of that 93,000 was just fuel, and was it for a past fuel, was it for current fuel, and how much of it was bribing the fuel guys, because one of the guys that was really helpful to me actually helped steal a 727 out of a small island in the South Pacific, and it was actually more of a repossession. And one of the first things they did was they went to the fuel shack. They paid for the gas. They paid the guys that worked there to keep their mouth shut. And then they went up to the tower, paid the tower a little bit of money to keep their mouth shut. And then once everybody was paid off, they hopped in the airplane real quick, fired up the engines, took off, and reclaimed the aircraft.
Oh, my gosh. That's a fascinating story. Just on a side note, does this happen more often than the average person realizes? Stories like that of repossessions. I know there was a reality show from a few years ago about like private planes and little Cessnas getting repossessed. But something
you watch that show, and I know the gentleman you're talking about, and yes, he does that. He shows up at the airfield. I've seen him grab Airbus 310s, 319s, stuff like that. And, you know, he walks in with all the paperwork. He works as fast as he can before the people that are controlling the aircraft find out, and he tries to get out of there because it can get very ugly very quickly.
Yeah, I bet.
Because you're talking about big money here.
Yes.
People get really unhappy and do things they might not otherwise do when big money is at stake.
Yeah, this isn't somebody's 2011 Honda Accord that's getting repossessed. It's a little bit bigger deal than that. Let's cover one more aspect of this that I think is of importance regarding all this. Once again, because I think we're foreshadowing a little bit. Tell the listeners a little bit about African radar and flying in that country.
Well, Africa's a continent.
Yeah, a continent. I'm sorry. Yes, a continent, of course.
Most people think that there's global coverage radar, and it's just not the case. It's just not the case. Even here in the United States, there are large regions of this country that are not subject to low-altitude radar. Mm-hmm. It gets infinitely worse once you go overseas. Now, most long-range radars only go out 250 nautical miles, thereabout. But if you're flying, because of the curvature of the Earth, it's real easy to get under that radar, and nobody would know you were there. On top of that, you have radars primarily only in the capitals and only in the richer countries in Africa. Hmm. There are huge areas of that continent where there's no radar coverage whatsoever. And a lot of people think that the NSA can see everything that's happening over there, and they can't. There is an over-the-horizon radar that is operated in places like Crete, and it's looking towards Syria and Iraq and those areas. There's three radar stations, one of them here in Virginia that is watching the Caribbean. There's another one down in Puerto Rico that's also watching out over the Caribbean. And these are most of these radars are looking in the United States are looking for drug runnings. Mm-hmm. But those radars have no accuracy to them. They know there's somebody out there. So in order to track something accurately, you need a tracking radar. And even if there was an over-the-horizon radar out there over Africa, it's not going to cover the whole continent. And there's most certainly not very much tracking radar. So it's easy for somebody to take off and get just outside of a capital area, and that's wild, wild west flying. And I've experienced that myself. That's one of the great allures of Africa for a pilot, is that basically you can do anything you want to once you get outside of a populated area.
So now that we've culminated all this information, we know a little bit about the man, we know a little bit about the aircraft, we know a little bit about the market that seems to be shady of aircraft on the secondary and lesser markets. What did Ben Padilla and this associate of his that I can't think of his name right at this second, but
John Mutantu.
Thank you. Could they have stolen this jet?
Absolutely. I filed an FOIA with the FBI, and I got back lots of redacted documents, but I don't think the FBI ever realized that the Congolese national, Jean Mutantu, was a flight engineer. That guy was fully rated on the 727, the 707, and numerous other aircraft as a flight engineer. And I never saw anything in the paperwork that suggested that the FBI was aware that he was a competent, well-regarded flight engineer.
Hmm.
Now, part of the problem in all this was that there were two Mutantus. And this was when I discovered that I had two Mutantus. It was just mind-boggling. When the Americans were in Luanda, they hired what they said was a 19-year-old kid who was local. And he said his name was John Mutantu. The kid was used to do nothing but haul fuel hoses, to do nasty, dirty work, and he knew nothing about airplanes. The Congolese national, Mutantu, was a professional aviator.
Wow.
And I don't think the FBI ever put that together.
Wow. Now, we should be clear about one thing, and you can explain maybe a little bit of this to the listeners. Technically, a 727 needs three people to fly it, technically. You know,
right.
Now, that is different than today if people on a passenger jet, 737, 757, they only see a pilot, a co-pilot in the cockpit. But on a 727, when it was built, it was made for three people to be in the cockpit, right?
That is absolutely correct.
But it doesn't need three people to technically fly it.
It doesn't need three people to fly it as long as nothing goes wrong.
Okay.
Now, the flight engineer position, in many, many cases, was a stepping stone to co-pilot and then pilot. So guys who are rated in the right and left seat, a lot of times, already have had the job of the flight engineer. So it would be really easy for, let's say, a co-pilot who used to be a flight engineer to hop up from his seat, go to the engineer's position right behind him, and set all the knobs and switches that are needed for a departure, which is the most complex part of the flight. And then he hops back into his seat, and he helps pilot manhandle the aircraft. And then once they're at altitude, he pops up again. He adjusts the fuel flows and which tanks are being emptied, and then he gets back into his seat. So it is possible. I've heard more than one pilot, co-pilot, who had that flight engineer experience say, yeah, it could be done, but not if something was going wrong. If you had problems, then you really had problems.
So what you're saying is Ben Charles Padilla, with his qualifications and his experience and this other person, they could have gotten that plane off the ground and up to a certain altitude to fly it.
No. Ben Charles Padilla was not a qualified pilot.
Oh, okay.
He had a private pilot's license. But I never talked to anybody that said he would be competent to fly a 727. A 727, it's a hot rod of an airplane. And you got to be sharp. You got to be on your game. I know a pilot who tried to help Ben go from the flight engineer's position to a co-pilot's position in a four-engine jet called the DC-8. And Ben was his friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me Ben couldn't hold altitude, he couldn't hold heading, he couldn't handle the aircraft. And if he couldn't handle that aircraft, he wasn't going to be able to handle the 727. There had to be three people on that flight deck the night it left.
Wow. Wow. See, this is something that I've read your article recently, but I don't think you put that in the article. But I know originally when we talked a few weeks ago, you had told me that. And that was new information to me. Do you have any suspicion of who that third person might have been?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident I know exactly who he was. And I know pretty much exactly where he is. But unfortunately, I don't have any way to get to him.
Could you reveal his name today on this show?
No.
Okay. Well, I had to try. But what you're saying is this person is still alive. this third person?
At last report, he was, and I've had asked for some folks with connections in that part of the world to verify he is still with us. But he, this gentleman that I'm referring to, was a certified 727 pilot, and he was in Luanda, and he knew some of the players involved in this little saga.
So it's interesting to me, in listening to all this, that only two people were seen going to the plane, but your suspicion is there was a third person who was part, could have been, I mean, we don't technically know, it's still unsolved, but could have been on the plane as well, but just was not seen getting on the plane at that time of the day or something. Somehow he got onto the plane without anybody else seeing.
Yeah, very likely. And there was a report that two people were seen in the cockpit on the flight deck, pilot mm-hmm. and co-pilot. Well, you wouldn't be able to see the flight engineer if you were looking from the ground up into the cockpit, because the flight engineer sits behind the co-pilot and he's in a little hole. It'd be almost impossible if from the ground. But Mutantu was an African. And the two folks that were described as being in the right and left seat, neither one of them were described as African.
Huh. Yeah, just to give the, you know, being that I know, at least I've seen a 727 cockpit before, the flight engineer sits behind on the right side of the plane, you know, not very close to the pilots. I mean, it's farther than, like, the back seat of a car. It's farther behind than that, right?
Not really.
Oh, it's about that close? Okay.
Yeah, they are. They're pretty daggum close. I mean,
oh, okay.
If you're in the right seat, you can turn around and put your hand on the shoulder of the flight engineer.
All right. Okay, but still, that would be enough that, the of course, the windshields in any jet are not too big. So, yeah, it would be difficult to see somebody in the back seat. So I guess what we're saying here is there's a lot of evidence out there that Ben Charles Padilla, along with these two other gentlemen, are still alive. So let's talk a little bit about that. As you have stated, Ben Charles Padilla, there have been sightings of him.
Yes, yes. And there were reports that he was sighted in Kinshasa in the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm-hmm. And I have reports that Mutantu's wife had word that her husband was stuck in a jail in Nigeria. And there are other reports of the aircraft actually being spotted in Kinshasa in 2010 by another 727 pilot and his co-pilot.
Wow. And obviously this third person that you suspect was involved, he's somewhere as well. He's been spotted. He's not in a jail. He's not in a jail, but he's out there somewhere. A free man.
Yep.
Wow. And so Ben Charles Padilla, see, the reason I bring this all up is because when I remember first hearing about this, I think some of the listeners realized I do have a fascination with plane crashes and things. And I remember when this happened, you know, my first belief was that this guy maybe was suicidal, got on this plane and crashed it into the ocean. And, you know, then I read your article and I hear all this information since, and it's totally changed my mind. And I thought this was such a compelling case. Do you think that you obviously continue to work on this case? Do you have hopes that one of these days, if Ben Charles Padilla is still alive, that you're going to be able to track him down? Or is that what you're trying to do right now?
Yeah, I think it'd be fair to say. I think he's still alive. Mm-hmm. I think I know where he has been. He's probably not there now. Mm-hmm. But some old-time African pilots have told me there are no secrets in Africa. Somewhere, somebody knows what happened. And I'm convinced that's the case. The people that know just don't want anybody else to know.
Now, let's be clear about something. This isn't, you're not saying, I think, you're not saying that this was some sort of insurance fraud. This was something else. Is that right?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I don't know what it was. I mean, there are certain arguments that can be made in each case, and the Padilla family would be outraged to hear anybody say that Ben was involved in the theft.
Right. No, no family wants to hear that, of course. Sure.
And they're absolutely convinced of that. Now, is that a possibility that it was done for an insurance thing? I have a hard time believing that because in order to have an insurance claim, you got to have a damaged aircraft. And if you don't have the aircraft, how can you show it's damaged?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And airplanes that are stolen, you know, it kind of falls in a gray area. Maury Joseph told me that there was no insurance claim made. I've heard other people say that there were plans for an insurance claim made, but the insurance company was a Nigerian fraud, and it was never a viable institution in the first place. So, hence, there was no money to be paid because there was none that existed.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many different plausible explanations. I'm not inclined to go with insurance fraud.
Okay. Was there anything, you know, being that you've, I mean, obviously that you covered that time around 2003 that this plane disappeared, was there anything like politically or something like that going on in Africa at the time where somebody would have said, you know what, I'd really like to have a jet? Something like that.
Well, you know, you got to remember 2003 was pretty soon after 9/11.
Right. Yeah, we haven't even touched upon that yet. Sure, sure.
And at the time the aircraft disappeared, I think it was a week after it disappeared, there was a G7 meeting in Europe. And the intelligence community was just almost in a panic about what the heck this airplane could be doing, because it would have had the range to made it to Europe and done another, you know, Twin Towers kind of attack. It could have hit any capital in the African continent. The Israelis were real concerned about it because they were a natural target. So you had the intelligence communities of a number of countries working very hard to figure out where that airplane went. And none of them succeeded, to my knowledge. And if they did, they sure didn't tell the FBI about it. And they sure as heck have managed to keep it quiet because none of the other folks that are in a position to know that kind of information have said anything about it. Kip Hawley was the director of the TSA at the time. And the incident so scared him that he got down to knowing the serial numbers on Boeing aircraft parts. And they were watching for any parts that had serial numbers that matched that aircraft. Every part on an airplane has a number on it. And that's part of the reason why it's impossible to really hide an airplane by just switching the data plate, because the serial numbers on the landing gear or the wing flaps or the elevators or the rudder, you know, all those numbers have got to match. And that's how you unmask an airplane, as a fraud. You know, you compare what the data plate says it is, and then you go through and you look at all the serial numbers on the rest of the aircraft and see what they indicate. So,
and just to be sure, if there's no way, I know this sounds crazy, but just for the layman, there's no way somebody could go through there and, like, take all those numbers off all those parts. That just could not conceivably be done.
No, and that would leave such a huge trail in its own right, you know?
Right, that's a good point. Right, right.
A part that doesn't have a serial number doesn't have any paperwork behind it to document its lifetime. Mm. And so if you don't have a serial number, you can't legally use it. So then you have to put it in an otherwise already illegal aircraft. And if you wipe all the serial numbers off an airplane, somebody's going to notice that pretty quickly.
Somebody sooner or later.
Yeah.
Right, right. Do you believe that that 727 is flying around in Africa right now, 13 years later?
No, I don't.
You don't? Oh.
I think after my story came out in 2010, that airplane probably went somewhere and very quietly got chopped up.
Just because of all the attention, and I know that the article that you wrote was very, very popular. I know you told me the statistics regarding how many people have read it over the last 6 years, and it's quite incredible, and you should be quite proud of that. I can see why somebody might have done that.
Yeah, 5 million people read it on the off the Air and Space Magazine's website, and I have been approached by many, many people subsequently who have read that article and just been staggered by it. So, it was a pretty amazing journey, and it started me down a real dark path. It got kind of scary there for a while.
Yes, you told me, if you can say this, if you want to answer this, you actually did get some threats.
Yeah, well, let's say I got lots of very stern warnings.
Okay.
From folks from within the intelligence community, from folks that were in law enforcement, from local pilots in Angola. Three or four times I was told that if I went over there looking for this airplane, I would most likely come back in a body bag if I came back at all. It would be very likely that a door would open somewhere over the jungle and I'd get thrown out the airplane.
Yeah, that reminds me of that movie, The Good Shepherd, with Matt Damon from about 8 years ago, where they pushed that girl out of a plane in Africa, I think.
Wow. Why do you think that is? I mean, this is just a plane, a plane. This is just, an aircraft engineer, an American. What do you
think?
The money.
It all goes back to money. I got into aviation and ultralights and gliders, and gradually as my career went through its track, I became involved in larger and larger aircraft. I noted that the larger and the more expensive the aircraft, the less savory some of the people are that are involved with it.
Yeah.
And you got to look at how some of these ghost aircraft, and that's what they call an airplane whose data plate doesn't match who it is, or if it's flying in Africa without a registration number at all, or if the registration doesn't match the paperwork on it. Mm-hmm. These aircraft are showing up in nefarious purposes. Like, I found one 727 in the middle of the desert in Mali, and it apparently had landed after flying in from South America, offloaded 9 tons of cocaine into the, I don't want to say the hands of Al-Qaeda, but there is a notorious bandit in central Mali who allied himself with Al-Qaeda, and he took on the French when they tried to take over the Mali government. But anyway, this, running drugs is a huge issue. People have no idea how much drugs are being flown out of South America and into West Africa. And what will happen is they'll land in some place like the desert in Mali, they'll offload it into four-wheel drive vehicles, and the vehicles go roaring across the open desert all the way up to North Africa and the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And from there, it gets smuggled across the Med into Europe, and that's where the final destination is. If they're not doing drug running, they may be doing gun running, The UN monitors weapons movement as closely as they can. It would be real easy for somebody to load up, a bunch of RPGs or AK-47s or ammunition and move it from point A to point B, and nobody would want that known. Or they could be picking up a whole bunch of armaments coming in from the Iranians that are destined to some of their Shiite Confederates, and they sure as heck aren't going to want somebody to know that that last mile or two is being done by an aircraft. So, and then there's people smuggling, and then there's just out crime. So these aircraft that are available so cheap are expendable. And that 727 that was burned in Mali, it may have been burned simply because it was an acceptable business expense. You know, we got our 9 tons of cocaine worth what, $500 million or something. What's an airplane that's worth $500,000?
Nothing.
It's a drop in the bucket.
Nothing.
So torch it, walk away from it.
You know, I'm listening to all this, and I think I said this the first time we talked, and I'm going to ask you this again. How much should the average American be troubled by all of this?
You know, that's a difficult question. You know, it's not like there are hundreds of aircraft out there doing this, but there are enough of them out there that our governments definitely are concerned. I knocked on the doors of just about every agency in the D.C. area and said, I'm looking at these missing aircraft, and the public affairs officer will go, wow, I had no idea. Let me look into this. I'll get right back to you. And then I never heard another word from them. And I would call them, and I would call them, and I would never get another return call back until I talked to Kip Holland, and he told me that what I was talking about was so classified and so black that the people I was talking to probably had no idea what was going on, and that the insiders were not even going to be telling the people talking to me what was going on. So, you know, how many 727s do you need to crash into another Twin Towers?
Right.
One? So, you know, I don't know. I don't want to fearmonger or anything, but it's definitely something that needs to be thought about.
I can tell you, I'm not a fearmonger, but I can tell you that I hear what you're saying. I read your story, and I know you did a follow-up story also about, you know, the jet market, the shadier side of it. And I just wonder how it is that we haven't had something like that since 2001. It almost is to the point where I hear you talking and I hear, why did they even bother hijacking our planes when they could have gotten something on the black market and done the same thing? You know what I mean? That almost would seem like it'd be easier. Or somebody hasn't done it since then, being that this market seems to be so loose and there are ways to get around the rules.
You know, there are a lot of people that are worried about that very much. You know, it would be, and that was one of the nightmare scenarios, that they would get an airplane like this, they would put together a crew, and they'd go out and they'd buy a small nuke from the North Koreans or maybe the Iranians, and they would load it onto the airplane, and they would chart, you know, amount a charter flight into, say, Atlanta or Miami or something like that. And the airplane would get over U.S. airspace, and 1,200 feet is a really good detonation altitude for a lot of nuclear weapons. So, yeah, it's something to worry about. But, you know, there are a lot of things to be worried about.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But you'd have to have a highly trained suicide crew. And we know that's possible, but how often do you get those kind of crews?
Yeah.
Plus, we have a lot of government people that are looking for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good thing. Let's wrap up the case of Ben Charles Padilla this way. Obviously, you have your suspicions. I agree. You know, maybe, you know, possibly 90% of what happened. Say you and I both get to live on this earth for another 50 years. Do you think this case will be solved as to actually really what happened?
Not without somebody who knows something talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's probably the kind of story that somebody might rattle off on his deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as these guys are thriving and doing fine, no, they're not going to talk about it. Even though the statute of limitations, this is what's really interesting. even if they caught the guys that stole the airplane, who would charge them? What country would they be charged with? They didn't break any American crimes because the crime didn't take place on American soil.
Hmm.
So what do they have to fear? You know, the Angolan government coming after them to charge them with theft? Hmm.
That's not going to happen.
Uh-uh. It's not.
Maybe could the owner of the jet who come after him? Come after them somehow? You know, in civil court, maybe?
If anybody was alive at that point, maybe. You know, you got to remember how cheap life is in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people die over there at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And nobody cares. I had one report came from a Scottish flight engineer who told me that Ben ran over a guy in Africa, killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened to him.
Well, I was just thinking, like, the owner of the aircraft could charge, you know, once again, if Ben Charles Padilla is still alive, and once again, that's just conjecture, and we have some sightings and things, could come after him in civil court in the United States? That wouldn't be the proper jurisdiction for something like this?
You'd need a lawyer to answer that one.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll just leave it at that. Tim, what are you working on now? Obviously, you're still working on this case, but... you and I had talked a little bit about Flight 370. What are you doing regarding that now?
Not a whole lot regarding that. One of the guys that came out of the woodwork got into that pretty deep in his job. And because I had some computer expertise with certain types of software, he had me run a whole bunch of simulations of, it basically was an exercise in four dimensions, time, distance, speed, and fuel.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make an airplane go from point A to point B and arrive at a certain point in time with a certain amount of fuel? That went on for about a solid month, and I think the evidence now is more conclusive than ever that it was suicide by pilot, which is really sad.
Yeah.
They continue to try and refine the satellite information to determine exactly where the aircraft may be, because it's hard to imagine how big that search area is. It is just enormous, and it's some of the deepest water on the whole planet.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you can, you know, refine your estimates of where it could be by 5 miles or 10 miles, by the time you narrow that band, you're talking hundreds of square miles that have been eliminated. You know,
yeah.
So that's one thing I've been working on. I'm also working on another story for Air and Space right now on lighted aircraft.
Say that again, please.
I'm working on a story for Air and Space right now on light attack aircraft.
Wow.
These are small airplanes that left the United States Air Force inventory back in 1991. And... the Air Force has been using F-16s and F-15s and now the F-35s to do close air support for guys on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with all this is, you know, an F-15, F-16, F-35, those are expensive aircraft to operate. You know,
yeah.
They're saying the F-35 is going to cost $35,000 a flight hour, whereas on a light attack aircraft, might cost you $1,000. So why don't we have some light attack aircraft out there? And it goes back to economics and money and politics and cultural latitude. So
what does light technically, what does light attack aircraft mean? to the layman? What would they see in their head? What should they see in their head when you'd say that?
Well, the easiest way probably is to think about something you might have seen in World War II, a World War II fighter
with a propeller.
Yeah. Or would... Yep. Turboprop, to be most accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the popular engine for almost all those aircraft are the same engines that are powering prop dusters. And it's the Pratt & Whitney PT-6A. And it's an incredibly reliable engine. It sips fuel comparatively. And you can buy one for pennies on the dollar for what it would cost to get even an F-15. So let's say you decided, well, let's get rid of one F-35. Well, you could probably just about buy an entire squadron or more of light attack aircraft and use them all over the world. So they represent the opposite extreme of the F-35. But the Air Force is so dependent on the F-35 is that they're trying to put as many dollars into it as they can, and they're trying to shut down the A-10 Warthog.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they think the F-35 will make a good ground attack aircraft. And that's where the light attack really shines, is in the close air support.
Right. Right, supporting ground troops, something like that.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Why send a sledgehammer when a fly swatter will do the job just as well?
Yes, I agree with you on that. I agree. Anywhere else that people can find you online? Do you have a website, Twitter, Facebook, anything that people can find you to find out what else you're doing? Feel free to tell my listeners, you know, all your information if you care to.
Okay.
If you'd like.
I'm on LinkedIn. And that's about as far as I really want to go. I do have a website, but it's way old and doesn't reflect what I'm doing these days. I'm doing a lot of writing. I'm trying to develop a TV show for the local PBS affiliate here, and it will be a program that focuses on aviation and space.
Love it.
And we're in the process of putting together a pilot episode right now. So lots going on.
All right. That sounds good. Great, Tim, and I'm sure the listeners will be looking for you on that. Great interview. Thank you for joining me. This is a fascinating story, and if anything pops up regarding the story, I hope you will keep me informed, because I'd like to maybe do a follow-up sometime down the road regarding all this. Who knows?
I would be happy to.
All right, great. Thank you. Thanks for joining me on Unfound.
My pleasure. Glad to do it.
All right.
There you go, my interview with Tim Wright. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Now, we should add on some points to what was covered in that interview. Some little points that were mentioned that we didn't quite get into. We need to put on the record that Ben Charles Padilla's family totally rejects the idea that he stole that plane. That he was in cahoots with some other people to fly the plane to some other location, as we talked about in the interview. They totally reject that. They think that the plane was hijacked. I guess the possibility that Ben Charles Padilla and his assistant went out there. There were already guys on the plane who overpowered those two men, took the plane into the air, and stole it. All right, that's what the family believes. You're going to have to choose to believe whatever you think. Do you think that Tim Wright? I personally believe that Tim Wright is correct. And you should know that when this originally happened in 2003, because I'm an aviation geek, at least on the crash side, that I thought it was a pilot suicide, something like that. This guy got onto the plane, maybe being away from his family, maybe he was having money problems, something like that. and had the skills to fly this plane, and Angola is so close to the Atlantic Ocean that he just took off and ditched it in the ocean somewhere and killed himself. What we know about aviation since then, that is not a crazy belief. We know what happened in the German Wings crash, where the pilot intentionally crashed the plane into a mountain in Europe. That guy was suffering from some mental issues, depression, was about to be suspended from his job because he couldn't pass some of the tests. We know about that story. Then there's Flight 370 that was mentioned at the end of the interview, where it's pretty clear now that one of the pilots, most likely the main pilot, took that plane and crashed it into the Indian Ocean on purpose. And if you start doing research on pilots crashing jets on purpose, there are quite a few stories out there about that. There are quite a few stories, more than you'd probably realize, where both the pilots and passengers got killed. The issue with that, and that's what I thought originally, but the issue is that none of these plane parts ever washed up on any shore anywhere, despite people having that suspicion and looking for the parts along the coast of Africa and elsewhere, depending on what the currents were doing in the Atlantic Ocean at the time. Could have maybe been crashed into the jungle somewhere. Once again, no reports of an explosion or sound of a crash or an unexplained fire or anything like that. Because you have to realize something, and once again, we got into that in the interview. If Ben Charles Padilla and this guy tried to take off in the plane, maybe they both had a death wish, let's say. They weren't going to be able to fly the plane too far, especially since night was coming. And then you get into the phenomenon known as spatial disorientation. You have to be qualified to fly at night because the effects that flying in a plane can have on your equilibrium. You can think the plane is doing one thing when it's doing something else, and there are many stories about that. These two men, if they were alone, were not going to be able to fly that plane very far, given their lack of skills and given that it was becoming night very quickly. The plane wouldn't have gotten very far before it would have fallen out of the sky. Okay? So knowing all of that, you can see why Tim Wright's belief that this plane was stolen makes a lot of sense. Now, as far as the sightings of Ben Charles Padilla, the sightings of his assistant, and then the sightings of this unnamed third person, unfortunately, I couldn't get Tim Wright to say the person's name on the air. Maybe somewhere down the road we'll know who that person was or is. You'll just have to judge that for yourself. The truth is that no authority, whether in the United States or elsewhere, have been able to track down Ben Charles Padilla. That's a fact. Nobody's been able to track down and take a picture of his assistant if he is in some jail somewhere. So you can see why this continues to be a story, and you can see why Tim Wright continues to be on the case. I thought it was an interesting story. It is a little disconcerting about the aircraft market, the jet market, and what goes on. And as I said in the interview, that it's just a wonder, given what's happened since September 11th, that one of these jets that has disappeared hasn't been used for an attack. You can judge that for yourself, why that hasn't happened. Maybe it's just a matter of luck. I don't know. Could it have been a thrill ride gone wrong? Once again, we get back to why hasn't any of the plane been discovered anywhere, the mangled wreckage anywhere, whether in the ocean or on land somewhere. Remember, it's been 13 years. could have been part of an insurance fraud case, but as once again stated in the interview, that no insurance claim has ever been made by Mari Joseph or anyone else. And I'm not sure that Mari Joseph or Keith Irwin or any of these other men who were involved in the actual business side of the plane being there had the money, had enough money to pay Ben Charles Padilla off to do it. So once again, we get back around to Tim Wright's suspicion that Ben, along with this other guy, maybe the guy wasn't even in on it, this other person wasn't even in on it, maybe he just didn't know what he was getting into, that, and there was somebody else on the plane, and they took off, never to be seen again. It landed in somewhere else in Africa and was being used to run, to drug run, to for human trafficking, some other use. And then once Tim's article came out, put a little too much suspicion out there, and it was probably trashed. But the reason this is called Unfound is because the case isn't solved, and that means that all of you get to hypothesize what you believe happened. I would also urge you to find Tim's article, the original article that he wrote, and read it for yourself. We didn't cover everything in the article. We covered the high points, and I asked him some questions that that I had after reading his article. Maybe after you read it, you'll have some questions as well, and maybe we can sort that out in the comments section for this show. But this is the first show Unfound. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to do what I can to give you a high-quality show every week with a quality interview of somebody that's close to a person who has disappeared, whether it's a family member or a writer, somebody like that. In this case, of course, it's been a writer who's been on the case for 13 years. But you can expect similar interviews in the future, and I hope you enjoy them as much as I do. And I thank you for listening to Unfound. I'm Ed Denson.